From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. We talk with one of the high school students who drafted a petition calling for responsible gun laws.
Because we can't vote, most of us can at least, we felt like this was the only way for our voices to be heard.
Plus, we'll find out about semi-automatic rifles from a gun store owner. Free Press columnist Nancy Kaffer talks to us about some of her recent columns, like self-driving cars instead of regional transit.
The idea that it is going to replace mass transportation is just nuts.
We'll hear from an expert on how the U.S. has dealt with poverty over the decades.
In the Great Depression, we had actually grown much more wealthy as a nation. And so when the Depression hit, people demanded change.
And we catch up with Grand Rapids area black businesses and the group's latest plans.
We're in the process of purchasing some property that can begin to be the start of a black business district here in the city of Grand Rapids.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Coming up this hour, we'll check back with an effort underway in Grand Rapids to create a black business district similar to a Greek town or a Chinatown. Also, we live in the richest nation on earth, so what should we be doing about poverty? We'll get some ideas from a U of M expert. But first, after 17 students were killed in a Florida school last week, some Kalamazoo high school students decided they needed to do something. Under the banner of Students Fighting Guns Since Adults Won't, eight students drafted a petition and put it up on change.org, a popular petition website. 65,000 people have signed it. Jenna Bacher is one of the students. She's a senior at Kalamazoo Center High School, and she joins us now. At what point did you and your classmates decide to do this?
Every day in my government class, we do current events, and we felt like we'd been talking about mass shootings too much. So then and there, we decided it's time to do something, and we sat down after that class and just wrote the petition.
Why did you feel this petition was the right action to take?
Because we can't vote, most of us can at least, we felt like this was the only way for our voices to be heard as students. A lot of us are under 18, especially after our shooting in Kalamazoo. Nothing was really done, so we wanted to see something be done.
The petition says in part, we demand change. What is the change you want?
Specifically, we're looking for longer waiting periods. A lot of when you go into a lot of gun stores, you can get that gun that day. We would like to look for maybe a couple of days or even a week. Other things, less assault rifles, maybe even a ban altogether, just because they have been such a major weapon in mass shootings.
Who is your petition aimed at?
Our petition is aimed at anyone that will listen, especially lawmakers, because nothing has been done so far. We're just trying to get as much support as we can and allow as many voices to be heard so that we can have some change.
Is this kind of protest against school shootings going to get any more traction than efforts in the past?
I really hope so, especially because this time the voice is coming from the children. With us, we are all high schoolers, and then also with the Parkland students. We hope that this will be a change because it's not just adults that are speaking out now.
So what do you think of the response so far on change.org?
We're very happy to see how many people are agreeing with us and supporting us. It was an immense amount of support. It was really slow at first, but this weekend we gained a lot more support. We've been reached out to with many local news stations and have been invited to speak, and we're very grateful and hope that it can keep rising.
What's next for your group?
We're hoping to speak. We've sent emails to many legislators, Michigan legislators. We're hoping to get our voices heard by our own representatives. We want there to be some sort of change. We're hoping that we can push it in Michigan and then eventually all the way to the national level.
Jenna Bacher is a Kalamazoo Central High School student. She and seven of her classmates put up a petition on change.org calling for, quote, comprehensive and responsible gun control policy. Jenna, thanks for taking time between classes. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I misspoke in the intro. I said 17 students. Actually, 17 people, students and adults. Meanwhile, among the adults, another mass shooting and another spate of outrage on social media by all sides in the American gun debate. Gun rights supporters often dismiss people who want more restrictions because those people don't seem to know what they're talking about when it comes to guns. The news media also don't always understand the difference between semi-automatic and automatic, or use terms such as assault rifle, which can be debated. Don Haig has owned Firing Line Gun Store in Westland for 15 years. He's also a retired police officer who worked in Westland for 25 years. Mr. Haig, we hear about the AR-15 all the time. Can you tell us exactly what is the AR-15 rifle?
Well, technically speaking, AR-15 is a moniker that people have given that particular firearm. It's actually called an Armalite rifle, and AR is short for Armalite. The Armalite rifle, or what I would call a modern sporting rifle, is chambered in a particular caliber at 2.223 inches. It was designed for the military just before we got into Vietnam, and the military wanted another rifle that was easier for the servicemen to carry and to be able to carry more rounds with a lighter bullet. So it was designed for the Vietnam era, and they've been using it since the 60s. So the military has been using that rifle for, 70 years, 60 years it's been around?
Yeah, I read that the original design started in the Armalite started making them in about the 1950s.
Yeah,
it wasn't
John
until
Stoner.
Later that they got the military contract. So who's the manufacturer of the AR-15 today?
Just about all your gun manufacturers make some form of that rifle. I mean,
So the patents are all expired and anybody
correct.
Can make it? Okay.
Correct. I mean, Colt, Armalite were the originators of that firearm, but now you have... There's probably 30, 40 different manufacturers of that firearm, and not only in the United States, but all over the world. FN, Fabrique Nationale, which makes more military weapons in the world than any other gun manufacturer, I believe is now making that rifle for our U.S. military.
When I was a kid, I hunted with a semi-automatic rifle, Woodstock. The ammunition went into a long tube underneath the barrel of the gun. How is that old semi-automatic rifle I had different from the AR-15?
The only real difference is they're both semi-automatic firearms, meaning when you pull the trigger, one bullet is fired. When you let go of the trigger resets itself, and you have to pull it again to fire another bullet. So it's the same gun you're talking about, with the exception of how you load it. The new modern sporting rifles are loaded by a magazine, a box magazine. So you load the magazine, and then you put the magazine into the firearm. And then when you're out of rounds, instead of putting in a tube like you talked about, you can put another magazine in or reload that magazine you just expired.
So we hear interchangeably the terms clip and magazine, but they're not the same. Could you tell us the difference between a clip and a magazine?
Well, a magazine is designed to fit into a particular firearm, and it's for a particular bullet round, because there's different calibers of bullets and different sizes of bullets. There's a generic name for your size of different bullets for different guns, for different firearms, but a magazine is designed to hold a set amount of bullets. It could hold 5 rounds, 10 rounds, 15 rounds, 30 rounds, 20 rounds.
And then what's a clip?
A clip is a bad terminology used to describe the proper terminology, nomenclature of a magazine.
Okay. So how do you define a high-capacity magazine?
Anything over 10 rounds would be a high-capacity. Anything over 20 rounds would be a high-capacity magazine. I mean, there's magazines designed to hold 100 rounds. You have some firearms that are belt-fed. It's endless. It's an endless amount of ammunition on a belt.
Do you have a lot of customers who want something, 30, 60, 100 rounds magazine?
Most of the people that come in to buy a modern sporting rifle, it comes issued usually with one 30-round or 20-round magazine. And 99% of my customers, they want that 30-round or 20-round magazine, nothing higher. And they'll get the lower ones if they're going to use it for hunting purposes, because you can use these firearms for hunting. And there's a lot of the people today that are using them for hunting and sporting and competition shooting, target practice, and self-defense.
The AR-15 is perhaps the most popular rifle ever. There are millions of them in the U.S. Why do gun enthusiasts like that rifle so much?
It's easy to operate. You can upgrade it with different... I tell people, think of a kit car. the Mustang is probably known as probably the most desirable car to have if you're going to upgrade it or put custom parts on it. And the modern sporting rifle, you can interchange parts on it. It's easy to maintain. The ammunition is for a rifle is relatively inexpensive compared to other rifle rounds. It's more expensive than a pistol cartridge, but it's still the ease of use of the firearm and the enjoyment people get when they use it for target sporting and competition makes it very desirable.
Who buys AR-15s? What's your typical customer for that or a similar semi-automatic rifle?
In our store, I would say the largest percentage of our customers are law enforcement officers, retired law enforcement officers, veterans, military veterans that have used that platform while they were in the service. They come out of the service, so they're used to that platform, and they want to use that. And competition shooters. We have a lot of people in the United States that are using that platform of a rifle for their competition shooting. I would say that most of our people are those customers.
It seems every so often there's a run on models like the AR-15, as well as people stocking up on ammunition. What's the concern?
Well, obviously, there's a concern that with the political environment, that at some point in time they're going to do a restriction on the ability to buy the ammunition or restriction on the ability to buy the firearm. That has not happened in my 15 years. There has been only one ban, and that was on capacity of magazines. And that sunset in, I believe, 89 or 92 or something like that. But since that time, you've been able to buy the higher capacity magazines. But every once in a while, when you see these tragic things happen, there's always a talk about some sort of laws being passed or restrictions being passed. So you get some people that think they want to own the firearm because they're afraid that they're going to lose that right to own that firearm under our Second Amendment.
Don Haig owns the Firing Line Gun Store in Westland. Thanks for the lesson.
You're welcome.
When we return, a plan for an African-American business district in Grand Rapids takes a step forward. And Detroit Free Press columnist Nancy Kaffer stops by the studios to give us her take on several statewide stories.
If we want things like roads, clean air, clean water to drink, good schools to educate our kids, we have to pay for them, and we're not paying for those things. Our school performance is plummeting. Our roads are crumbling.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham.
The best and the brightest.
Opportunities.
The next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
After more than 3 years, our innovation series, The Next Idea, will soon come to an end. We've been checking in on some of our previous contributors to see how they're doing. Jamil Robinson is the founder and curator of the group Grand Rapids Area Black Businesses, and when we last talked to him, one of his goals was to establish a black business district.
The advantages of having a black-owned business district is similar to when you think of Greektown, when you think of Chinatown. It's a cultural experience.
Jamil Robinson recently spoke with Cynthia Canty.
Since we last talked, you have some big news. You've purchased a property. Tell us about it.
I have. So, following up from our interview about a year and a half ago, man, time is flying. We've actually signed the option on some property, and we're in the process of purchasing some property that can begin to be, as we talked about a couple years ago, the start of a black business district here in the city of Grand Rapids.
And where is it? What building did you buy?
We bought a former bank, so it's an old Kent Bank or a former old Kent Bank. It's in the Seymour Square Business District here in the city of Grand Rapids.
And this really is, you know, your goal is to grow this black business district in Grand Rapids. So how do you see this all playing out now that you've got this building coming?
Well, we're going to do some really great and innovative things in this space. And so we just like to thank our partners, the Kent County Land Bank, for assisting us in purchasing this property. So the property has been vacant for a few years now. And so we were looking for a space. And so when we were contacted about the space, we definitely went in, checked it out, and, you know, saw that it was right for us. And so just looking at where it's located, it's located in an area in which is has high density and also has a lot of traffic, and we just look at this as a great opportunity to build upon what we've already been doing here virtually and now have a place that we can call our own and begin to build and accelerate and help other businesses grow out of the area with there being other opportunities in that same business district with being vacancy of commercial spaces. And so we're going to look forward to helping launch a lot of businesses in that area.
So it certainly sounds like this former bank is the anchor that you've really been looking for.
It is. It's really great. So the property sits on approximately, the square footage is around 4,500 square feet, which would give us a lot of opportunity to do some retail incubation in the front part, but then also do some acceleration of businesses in the back part, which would be more of a learning center where we'll collaborate with our partners here in the area.
And this is the accelerator initiative that you're launching.
It is. So we've, for the past year, we've been partnering with the City of Grand Rapids and Start Garden on what we call the Grant 5 Accelerator. And so this is be us expanding that accelerator program and bringing that and grounding that in a neighborhood in a business district. And so we've been fortunate to have and work with, over the past year and a half, 15 businesses that we've been assisting to accelerate.
What kind of businesses?
So we've been working with Malamaya Juice Bar, which is a fresh juice bar that is currently located within the downtown market in Grand Rapids. We've been working with Mosby's Popcorn, which is a gourmet popcorn shop. We've been working with a non-emergency medical transport company, Reliable Medical, for the past few months. We're working with a furniture store. So just a lot of different businesses, all great businesses that we've been working with. We've been working with a nail bar and salon, so Polished Nail Bar and Salon, and so Daddy's Dough Cookies, and so the list goes on and on, but a total of 15 businesses over the past year and a half now.
You know, it's only been a very few years since Forbes published a post that ranked Grand Rapids as the second worst city in this country for African Americans in terms of economic well-being. Do you think anything has changed in the city since that list came out?
As far as the thing that has changed has been, I guess, a heightened awareness around the disparities that exist. We still have a long ways to go in regards to moving the needle in any kind of positive direction. Right now, we're still seeking for there to be investments made. So, you know, to us in the African American community, this is a crisis. I know some entities are treating it as a crisis, but it's been more rhetoric than investments thus far. And so we're looking at how can we increase the amount of investments into what we consider and what large parts of the country would consider a crisis. When you talk about the poverty rate for African Americans in this city being nearly 45% of all African Americans in Grand Rapids live at or below poverty. And then within the area of the focus or neighborhood of the focus, the unemployment rate being 53% unemployment rate for African Americans. So to us, it's a crisis, and so it needs to be treated as such. And so we're seeking to leverage investments to really bring much needed resources and relief to the African American community here.
I think I hear you say, Jamil, talk is cheap. Back it up with some money.
All day.
Jamil, what kind of timetable is in your mind for having a really distinct Black-owned business district up and running in Grand Rapids?
You know, in my mind, you know, I would like for it to take shape over the next 2 to 3 years. But given as long as it typically takes for transformational investments to occur, you know, I see maybe 10 years before it's really defined and really distinct and robust. So if we look at Wealthy Street, even though Wealthy Street is kind of the poster child or is the poster child for gentrification in Grand Rapids, it took Wealthy Street about 10 years to be in the current state that it currently is as far as a robust business community. And so, you know, while my hopes and wishes will be that it will be within 2 to 3 years, you know, realistically, and at the speed of in which capital is being deployed, I see about 10 years.
Got to pack your patience.
You do.
Jamil Robinson is the founder, the curator of Grand Rapids Black Businesses. Best of luck to you, Jamil, and thank you so very much for being a part of The Next Idea.
Thanks for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Speaking of The Next Idea, a reminder about our Issues and Ale event tonight. You can join University of Michigan Ross School of Business Professor Jeff DeGraff, Stateside Executive Producer Joe Lindstroth, and a panel of business leaders from Grand Rapids, Ann Arbor, and Detroit tonight at 7 o'clock at Pretzel Bell in downtown Ann Arbor. They'll discuss why various regions of Michigan appear to be so disconnected and how we can work together to better move the state forward. That's Issues and Ale tonight, 7 o'clock, Pretzel Bell, Ann Arbor. Listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. As many of you know, Nancy Kaffer is a columnist with the Detroit Free Press. Her pieces can be biting, funny, and insightful. She joins me now to talk about some of the recent topics on which she's offered opinions. Let's start with a column you wrote in January. The headline is, quote, "Patterson snarks about transit, hackle, unsure regionalism is good for Macomb, I have a headache," end quote. For those of you who don't live in the Detroit region, L. Brooks Patterson is the county executive for Oakland County. Mark Hackle holds the same position in Macomb County. Patterson has a habit of dismissing Detroit altogether, but I kind of thought he was on board with the regional mass transit at one time.
I did, too. It seemed like he had been getting more cognizant of the need to have regional transit, the ways in which it would benefit Oakland, at least the ways in which Oakland needs a strong region to be able to thrive. It felt like we were moving toward this goal of getting functional regional transit. And then, you know, there have been these meetings happening behind closed doors among the top deputies of these regional leaders. Seemed like we were going to get something on the ballot this fall. And then, boom, here we are at a meeting of the big four. That's Macomb, Oakland, Wayne County executives, and the mayor of Detroit. And Brooks Patterson comes out with this. It was straight out of 2008 or 1998 or 1978, maybe.
Take your pick, yeah.
Very regressive, dismissive take on transit. He spent a great deal of time talking about what a waste a rail line from Detroit to Pontiac that used to exist was. Well, no one's talking about putting a rail line in from Detroit to Pontiac. This is not on the table. Mayor Mike Duggan had to kind of explain that to the audience. Yeah, well, we're not doing that. What we're talking about is effective busing. It was very bizarre. And it did give me a headache.
Hackle says he doesn't want to be a donor county to the transit system, implying Macomb would pay more in taxes than it actually hit in services from mass transit. But, I mean, driverless vehicles will work for us, so we'll just wait for those, right?
Yeah, sure. Hold tight. Coming soon to you in 2030. I mean, driverless vehicles and ride-sharing get thrown into this conversation as though they were a viable replacement for effective regional transit. They are not. Think about whether or not you could eliminate your car and take Uber everywhere. Maybe you could, but you're not the average person here in this region. It's just the idea that it is going to replace mass transportation is just nuts. And even if there were any hope of this, we're talking decades from now. And what we need right now is transportation that can get people who need jobs to job centers. People need that, and employers need that. That gets left out of the conversation a lot. Talk to people who work in big employment corridors, you know, people who run hotels along Big Beaver Road in Troy, people who run manufacturing facilities out in places like Livonia. They need workers. They need workers to be able to get there. This is not an altruistic thing. This is important for the economy.
Let's segue to another column you wrote. Taxes are good. No, really, they are. Right about now, every Republican listener is rolling their eyes. Of course, that's what Kaffer wrote. we don't pay enough taxes is the argument. What's your elevator pitch on that one?
I'll let Oliver Wendell Holmes give the elevator pitch on that, as he was famously quoted as saying, taxes are the price of admission to a civilized society. If we want things like roads, clean air, clean water to drink, good schools to educate our kids, we have to pay for them. And we're not paying for those things. Our school performance is plummeting. Our roads are crumbling. Our water quality is, you know, pretty good unless you live in Flint or in some place that struggles to treat its water properly. We all have old pipes. The reason our water is safe is because we're treating it properly. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we need to pay for if we want to continue to have it. I'm not talking about building new things. I'm talking about maintaining what we have. That costs money.
But it's hidden infrastructure. I mean, mm-hmm. We can't see shiny new pipes.
I mean, at my house, when I had to replace some plumbing, it really galled me because, you know, I really like spending money on things that are going to be closed up in a wall no one will ever see so that my bathroom will work properly. And yet, if my bathroom doesn't work properly, that's a problem, right? So, I mean, you know, I would like to buy a new couch or maybe a great rug. Those are things you can see and enjoy. But if I don't have a functioning kitchen sink, then no one's going to come sit on my couch, right?
For all the things you just mentioned about crumbling infrastructure, school performance plummeting, the safety net stretched to the limits, an acquaintance of mine likes to say the state is working its way to becoming Mississippi. I wanted to talk about one element that we haven't mentioned, and that's eliminating regulations that were put in place to stop water contamination and other pollution. To that point, Senator Tom Casperson wants some oversight of the Department of Environmental Quality because all they're doing is trying to save the planet. He believes it's out of control, it's too influenced by tree-hugging environmentalists, and he wants politically appointed boards to review the rules that DEQ puts out and change them if necessary, review permitting, offering advice to the governor and the legislature. What's the problem with that? What could go wrong?
It's literally insane is the problem with that. You know, I mean, we have a Department of Environmental Quality that's supposed to enforce regulations put in place to ensure that we have clean air to breathe and safe water to drink, because those are things we have to live. And yes, we need to have a strong economy. We need to have business and industry able to do business. The DEQ is supposed to be there to help balance those needs, ensure that business can do business in a way that makes, you know, that keeps us safe and healthy. I think that you would be hard-pressed to find people living in places like Southwest Detroit in proximity to petroleum plants, refineries, other you know, very with the potential to pollute or that do pollute industry. You'd be really hard-pressed to talk to those folks and hear the story that the DEQ is out of control in its planet-saving mission. They make a lot of decisions that I think are a little too business-friendly. But Senator Casperson's idea is that we need to have boards that would review these decisions made by the DEQ. Those boards are only available to people who have applied for a permit. So if you live in Southwest Detroit or in the city of Flint or anywhere, you can't come to the board and say, I think this decision was too permissive. Can you make a decision that would keep me safer? Only the business, because they're the ones who apply for the permit, can come to the board and say, this decision was too harsh. I need more ability to increase the output of this certain chemical or whatever they're asking for. So this is a way for industry to work around DEQ regulations, and it's just we have a DEQ to make these decisions, and our governor and our legislature should back that entity, not try to defang it.
Yeah, a lot of the critics have compared it to fox watching the hen house.
That's a cliche, but it's a cliche for a good reason, because it's an accurate description of what's happening here, or what would happen here if this legislation becomes law.
Right.
Or this proposed legislation becomes law.
There was a little turmoil in the Democratic Party recently. The mayor of Detroit and some other leading Democrats tried to recruit some white male Democrats to run against Gretchen Whitmer to be nominated the Dems candidate for governor. What are women in the Democratic Party saying about that situation?
A lot of women are getting pretty tired of this. Now, to be fair, when Mark Schauer was the candidate and Virge Bernero were the Democratic gubernatorial candidates in previous years, I think there were also efforts to get someone else on the ticket. They were both perceived as weak candidates. But they didn't seem to continue into January of the year in which the election was going to be held. I think people had pretty much accepted that these guys were the candidates by that time. You know, I talked to more than a dozen really politically active women. Some of them loved Gretchen Whitmer as a candidate. Some of them had their own reservations about her as a candidate. The vast majority of them said that the ship has sailed. Whether you loved her, were lukewarm, didn't think she was great, it was time to get on board and get behind her to support her as the candidate.
One more question about Whitmer's campaign. This recruiting effort by Detroit Mayor Duggan, trying to get a white male in the candidacy, can Republicans use that in any way against Whitmer if she's picked for the general election?
If I'm Bill Schuette, the attorney general who's a gubernatorial candidate right now I'm already working on my attack ad. You know, this is the candidate your own party didn't want. I'm thinking of an ad that could run in Detroit. Your mayor didn't want this candidate. I mean, it seems like a huge risk in terms of handing return fire to the opposite side.
Nancy Kaffer is a columnist with the Detroit Free Press. It's nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Ever since the New Deal, the federal government has tried to address the issue of poverty. There was even a war declared against it by President Lyndon Johnson. So why can't we come up with solutions that work?
You know, I would say across political ideologies, people do want to help the poor. Actually, when you look at a nationally representative sample and say, should we do more or less to help the poor, something like 60% of Americans say more. And so I think we have to find the ways, instead of thinking of this huge amorphous thing of poverty, right? Let's try to figure out tangible solutions that can really get at the issues in an impactful way.
That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia County. We're going to talk about one of the core issues in the partisan divide in this nation, poverty. It's an ancient problem. In the Christian Gospel of John, there's an argument between Jesus and his disciple Judas. And within the argument, Jesus says, "You will always have the poor among you." So what can this society do about that? Under President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program, a war on poverty was declared, and at that time, national poverty rate was about 19% of the population. Today, it's about 14% of Americans living in poverty. Liberals believe this country can do better. Conservatives feel the government has designed a program that has led to generations of poor Americans to become dependent on government handouts. They also believe many people game the system. Laws ranging from welfare drug screening to a recent proposal to cut food stamps by half and instead supply boxes of non-perishable food items have been proposed. Joining me to talk about poverty in America and in Michigan is Luke Schaefer. He's an associate professor at the University of Michigan, author and poverty expert. So, welcome.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the definition. What is poverty as it applies to Americans?
Well, when we think of poverty broadly, we think of a family who doesn't have the resources that they need for a minimum base level of living. In the United States, we've been following the same threshold, just updating it for inflation. It was originally based on the minimum food diet that USDA thought that you needed to have a minimum amount of food. And we've just been multiplying that by three because back when we started it in the 1950s and 1960s, food accounted for about a third of the budget of a family. So it's not a particularly, I think you would say, well-designed measure, but we've had some updates to it. And in general, in the United States, we think a family of four might be around the poverty threshold at $23,000, $24,000 a year.
So it's the richest nation in the world. Why do we even have poverty in this country? How does that happen?
Well, we've seen a lot of the stratification of society in the United States, increasing economic returns at the top and problems, especially at the bottom, over the last few decades. You know, the United States is a bit exceptional in its levels of poverty relative to many of our Western industrialized counterparts. I think it has to do with our systems. It has to do with changes in family formation. It has to do with economics. And, you know, one thing that in our work at the University of Michigan we found is often I think people going into to solve poverty are looking for some silver bullet, some one thing that's going to do it. And we really say there is no silver bullet because poverty is a big topic. There's a lot in there, right? There are people who are just down on their luck and they're going to be okay next year. And then you have deep intergenerational poverty of families who are poor, whose parents were poor, and so many different things like residential segregation that we know is a big factor in the Detroit area. Different
both race access, and class.
Both
right?
race and class, right? Different access to higher education, different access to early childhood education. And so we really think you have to look across the range of issues and try to make concrete progress on each of them.
So let's talk about this historically. In the U.S., prior to the Great Society program by Lyndon Johnson, what did we do about poverty?
Well, the answer before the Great Depression in the 1930s was not much. In fact, the federal government really thought poverty wasn't their purview. So addressing poverty was really left to states and localities. In many cases, took the form of the poorhouse, that there was this place that could be feared, right, that if you had nothing else, you would go into. And there was some outdoor relief as well of helping with coal or helping with bread, but it was always pretty limited. In the Great Depression, we had actually grown much more wealthy as a nation. And so when the Depression hit, people demanded change. They demanded something better. And I think out of that came the Social Security Act of 1935 that really put in place our social safety net in a lot of ways. Social Security, old age Social Security came out of that. And I often ask my students, what was the most effective anti-poverty program the United States has ever established? And often people don't think of Social Security, but as you watch these checks roll in, elderly poverty just plummets over the course of a couple decades. Unemployment insurance, we have a lot of research now showing the important effects of unemployment insurance during the Great Recession when unemployment was at its highest. And that was established in that. And a number of other programs, including the controversial Aid to Dependent Children, sort of the predecessor to what became known as cash welfare.
What kind of ways can government effectively help poor families?
Well, one of the interesting shifts that we've seen, especially since the 1990s, is we've actually become a lot more generous with poor families when they are working. We have this program called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is the most effective and perhaps most arcanely named social policy that we have that supplements paychecks. So when you're working, you might get, let's say you're a single mom with two kids, making maybe $16,000 a year, you might get an earned income tax credit tax refund, which is more than you paid in income taxes of $3,000, $4,000, maybe up to $5,000. And that's been really effective. And you saw a lot of poor families moving into the labor market. We've also actually made a lot of our policies more accessible to the low-wage working population. So food stamps now called SNAP and public health insurance cover a lot of people who are working. In fact, a big chunk of the population getting these benefits are working. But what we've done is become less generous with the families at the very bottom, just as you spoke about, families who are unable to maintain work. Interestingly, when you look at a lot of those families, they were working at some time in the past. Some of them have structural barriers that means they just can't work. And the changes we made to the cash safety net, this program that started as AFDC, welfare, means that that's become far less accessible to families at the very bottom than it was before.
I should note, Michigan followed the federal government in earned income tax credit, and then a few years ago cut it back substantially. So I'm just wondering what kind of impact that's had.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the programs that have been suggested, starting with this work for welfare idea. What are the pros and cons?
I think that there's a lot of traction to these work requirements. One of the things we know about the earned income tax credit, I think, is how effective providing incentives to work, right? Trying to reduce some of the barriers. So in my own work, I've done both quantitative work. I love data. Spreadsheets make me feel warm inside. But I've also tried to go out and meet families and get to know families. And so one of my recent book, $2 a Day, was about families who are in deep, deep poverty.
Explain $2 a day. What do you mean by that?
So with the families in the book that we follow, we're looking at families who have been surviving on cash incomes of under $2 per person per day for some period of time.
Wow.
And so one of the things we see after this welfare reform in 1996 is a big upsurge in the number of those families. So they might have SNAP, they might have food stamps, they, in very few cases, they might have a housing subsidy, but they have no cash. And so this book is about trying to understand what does it mean to be in 21st century America without any money. When we would ask these families, if we came back in a year and you were doing better, what would it look like? They would always say, I'd be in a stable job that was paying $10 to $12 an hour. That was the band that we always heard about, and have a place of our own. And so, you know, I think policy that's going to be effective needs to understand that families really do want to work. And when we provide resources, when we do subsidized jobs programs, like Community Ventures is a program that Governor Snyder started that I think been very effective in making partnership with employers to create positions that didn't exist otherwise. When we do those sorts of things, people respond and they can be effective. Now, when we impose requirements, I think the biggest problems with those is that you do have some families that have a multitude of barriers to being successful in the labor market. And I think many would argue that as a society, we should protect those folks too. We should have a safety net that catches you when you fall to the very bottom. But even above and beyond that, many of these programs, when we impose work requirements, are just rife with problems in implementation. There's confusion about what exactly is required. In the case of TANF work requirements, when we changed our welfare system, we said to states, you have to have a certain percentage of your welfare recipients working. But we also created these incentives in the roles to just remove people from the roles, and they could get that counted as that they had met these work requirements. And so we created these sort of adverse incentives not to really put a lot of money into helping people find work and maintain work, but rather to just reducing the caseloads, just figuring out ways to kick people off. And then, to make matters worse, we said to states, you get to keep the money and do other things with it if you don't use it for cash welfare. And so in Michigan, we actually have a circumstance where $100 million of our welfare money goes to college scholarships. There's a great Detroit Free Press Bridge magazine article, right, on exactly that.
What was your reaction when you heard about the proposal in President Donald Trump's budget to cut SNAP, the food stamp program, in half and then send boxes of food to recipients?
Well, my first reaction was anger. I think that this proposal, you know, SNAP is a program that has had bipartisan support for a long time, and we certainly have debates about it, but it's historically been a very successful program. We know we have great research that follows, tracks kids as SNAP was being rolled out during the 1970s and sees that can have long-term positive health impacts on families. And, you know, when you look at the evidence, you see that most working-age adults who can work and are on SNAP are working. So a program like that, I think, just takes us exactly in the wrong direction. And beyond that, as a social policy researcher, what I've come to think is that usually the simpler you can make programs, the better, right? And if we go to a program where we're creating boxed meals, it's just incredibly inefficient. So beyond, I think, taking us in the wrong direction in terms of the investment that we're going to make in poor families, many of whom are working, it's a bad use of resources because some of that, you know, you think of these leaky buckets of a program like that. Who's going to make the boxed meals? What's their take going to be? And, you know, I think if a program like that were seriously considered, you would see quite a bit of pushback from food retailers, who are one of the groups that are really supportive of a program like SNAP.
You've been working on a project at the University of Michigan called Poverty Solutions. When this topic is so complex, where do you even start?
Well, that's why we think that you need to start with actionable changes, concrete things that will make a difference in people's lives, and figure out how we change those. So we're doing a lot of work around tax foreclosure in the city of Detroit, and have formed some partnerships with community-based organizations, with the mayor's office, with Quicken Loans, with some new strategies that we really think can help stem the tide of tax foreclosure in that city. It's also really interesting when this work takes you in directions that you might never expect it to. So if you think about the major barriers that face especially families in Detroit from escaping poverty, I bet one thing that doesn't come to mind is auto insurance. Yeah, we know auto insurance is incredibly expensive in the city.
Right, it's highest in the nation.
Yeah, highest in the nation. And in Michigan, it's incredibly high relative to what we pay here. So, you know, some of the estimates we've seen are that families are spending $6,000 for an annual premium. For the person at the median income in Detroit, that's something like 20% of their income. So this is one of those issues that I think does go across party lines, right? One of the things that I found is that, you know, I would say across political ideologies, people do want to help the poor. Actually, when you look at a nationally representative sample and say, should we do more or less to help the poor, something like 60% of Americans say more. And so I think we have to find the ways that we can actually cross these boundaries and figure out ways that we can improve conditions in very concrete ways. Instead of thinking of this huge amorphous thing of poverty, right? Let's try to figure out tangible solutions that can really get at the issues in an impactful way. We're just releasing a new brief on public school child homelessness. So we see huge rates of kids who are either homeless or temporarily doubled up all across the state. And we know from some great research done by researchers at Michigan State that marker of homelessness and housing instability is associated with a lot of adverse educational outcomes. So I think that's something that we can really do a much better job of, and we can problem solve across party lines to figure out ways to address it.
I want to hit three bullet points that you've been talking about, and let's start with that reducing education disparities. How do you go about that?
Well, again, I think we have to look at concrete ways to tackle it. Let's be problem solvers. So at the University of Michigan, my colleague Sue Donarski and others started something called the Hale Scholarship, where they realized at a place like U of M, there's a lot more aid than is generally known by a lot of low-income students. And so you had a lot of students who could have gotten into U of M, would have gotten significant financial aid, but don't even apply.
What about K through 12, though?
Well, K through 12, I think, is probably the place that we see the best evidence for significant investments, partly done from research here in Ypsilanti at Perry Preschool that we
right.
saw a big investment in kids. Has ripple effects across the lifetime. My colleague Martha Bailey has a new paper that shows the positive impacts across the lifetime of even Head Start. But going back to that, actually to the child homelessness point, often we think when we're thinking about education, the things that we have to do are all in the classroom, right? We have to teach differently, teach more effectively. But so much of what's going on in the classroom has got to be seen through the lens of what's going on at home, right? And if you don't have a stable place to live, which a lot of kids, 3% of all public school students in Michigan don't have a stable place to live, according to the state's own data, then we're never going to be able to really sort of push the dial on those types of outcomes.
Expanding economic opportunity. That's a broad subject. Give me the highlights.
We think that we can do more to increase the number of jobs that are available to families over the long term. So we're actually partnering with a group called the Institute for Health Policy Innovation that's doing a major infusion of community health workers in the Cody Rouge neighborhood of Detroit. And we know from experimental evidence that these community health workers that are usually come from disadvantaged communities and go back and serve can really be effective in improving health. But we need to prove that it can have an impact at the community level. So this is a community level study to see if these can improve health. To me, though, it's also a jobs strategy, right? That if we can find a financial mechanism to increase the number of community health workers, we can both improve health and increase the number of meaningful jobs available.
You're going to be speaking at the Michigan Senate building tomorrow in Lansing. Who's the audience and what's your goal there?
Yeah, well, we're going to be talking to a group called the Wolverine Caucus that are legislators and policymakers who all have University of Michigan connections. And one of my primary goals is that Poverty Solutions, our mission is to partner with communities and policymakers to find new ways to prevent and alleviate poverty. So we want to partner with anybody, and we want all the best ideas. And it's really a matter of trying to reach out and find partners and say, hey, the University of Michigan is interested in these ideas that can have concrete positive impacts on people's lives and build knowledge that can be scaled all across the country. So I'm going to be talking about a county-by-county map that's on our website, poverty.umich.edu, that tracks indicators of well-being all across the entire state. We've got this new map where you can see how your school district is doing with student homelessness. And we're hoping that these resources can really help shape policy, you know, shape our understanding of disadvantage and the right policies to address it.
We'll link to those sites on the web, so look for that story there. Luke Schaefer is the Director of Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan, an interdisciplinary university-level initiative that seeks to inform, identify, and test innovative strategies to prevent and alleviate poverty. Thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Danny Hensel, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.